It's August 15th, 1971. President Richard Nixon appears on live television and announces that the United States will no longer convert dollars into gold.
I have directed Secretary Connally to suspend temporarily the convertibility of the dollar into gold or other reserve assets.
It seems like a minor technicality, but what follows is monumental. Money, once anchored to something physical, becomes pure fiat currency, backed by nothing more than government decree. Immediately thereafter, things begin to change. Global debt takes a life of its own, and over the next few decades, it balloons from billions to trillions. Today, it stands at $345 trillion, give or take. That's three times the size of the entire global economy. America alone accounts for $38 trillion of that. But there's something strange about all this. You see, the US owes China roughly $770 billion. Yet China itself is drowning in $18 trillion worth of debt. Much of it sits with Chinese banks, the same banks that also own American debt. American banks, in turn, are holding debt from China, Europe, and just about everyone else. But here's the paradox. If everyone owes money to everyone else, then who is all that money actually going to? The answer isn't what you think. Follow the money far enough, and the trail circles back to where it started. The world essentially owes money to itself, and it works so long as no one checks the math. Today's video is sponsored by SIFT. Every day, we're flooded with information. There are too many headlines, too little context, and half the story is happening in languages most of us don't even see or understand. SIFT takes a completely different approach. Instead of chasing headlines, you start with a topic you actually care about. SIFT then scans trusted local and global sources across countries and languages and translates and summarizes the key developments into one clear, readable feed. So, you're not just seeing how a story is framed, you're seeing what's actually happening, often before it reaches mainstream coverage. It's less about comparing headlines, and more about following how a topic actually evolves around the world. It's loved by thousands of people, and is even the number one ranking news app in several countries. SIFT builds a personalized feed around whatever you want to follow. And because it pulls from local sources worldwide, you get broader coverage, real context, and clarity you won't get from just one country's media without bouncing between the apps. It also stays on top of updates with real-time coverage and notifications, and if you want the full context, you can always click through and go deeper. So, if you want to actually understand what's happening in the world, not just scroll past it, search SIFT and download the app for free on the App Store or Google Play. Debt is as old as civilization itself. Long before banks or paper money, debt was simply a promise. A neighbor lends you a bag of grain in spring, and come harvest, you pay them back, maybe with a little extra as thanks. This is how societies operated for thousands of years. However, as trade expanded beyond local communities, these arrangements grew more complex. During the Renaissance, Italian banking houses created credit instruments, ways to transfer debt rather than just hold it personally. This allowed merchants to do business across continents without carrying chests of gold. The real breakthrough, however, came in 1694, when Britain faced a funding crisis under King William III. The Royal Navy desperately needed £1.2 million to finance the war with France, but the government's credit was poor and direct borrowing proved impossible. So the Royal Court came up with an ingenious solution. Create a corporation called the Bank of England and allow investors to become shareholders. The bank would then lend the money to the government and charge 8% interest. In return, it received government bonds, which could be resold to the public or to anyone willing to buy them. Suddenly, for the first time, ordinary citizens could effectively lend money to the state through a reliable agent. It was a simple scheme, but it changed everything. States could now raise massive sums without hiking taxes or draining their treasuries. The system quickly spread across Europe and became the bedrock of early capitalism. Then, during the Industrial Revolution, the system went into overdrive. Factories, railroads, and infrastructure required unprecedented amounts of capital, far more than any single wealthy individual could muster. The banks that had been set up pulled saving deposits and lent them to industrialists. By doing so, borrowing became not just useful but structurally necessary for economic growth. By the 20th century, World War I and World War II pushed countries to borrow at scales never before seen, not just to fight but to rebuild afterward. In 1944, the Bretton Woods Agreement made the US dollar the centerpiece of the global financial system, with currencies tied to the dollar and the dollar tied to gold. But gold was limited and economies had to grow. So, as US spending accelerated during the Vietnam War and the Great Society programs, there wasn't enough gold to back the flood of dollars circulating globally, forcing Nixon to sever the link in 1971. The consequences were profound. From that point forward, governments gained the ability to create money at will. And with the old restraints gone, a new system emerged where debt could expand as long as lenders remained confident in government decrees. Steadily, throughout the 1980s, nations discovered that borrowing wasn't just useful in wartime, it could fuel peacetime growth too. And so, governments borrowed to build schools, repair roads, and pull economies out of recession. Debt stopped being a last resort and became standard operating procedure. Today, debt is how things get built, how recessions are managed, and how political promises are kept. Debt is no longer an anomaly in the system, it has become the system itself. The United States offers the clearest example of how this self-reinforcing system actually works. With $38 trillion in debt, no other country comes even close, yet roughly 70% of that debt is owed to Americans themselves. The US, in essence, borrows from its own citizens. You see, when someone deposits money in a bank, it doesn't just sit in a vault. Banks put that money to work, trying to grow it so they can pass some interest back to depositors. They do this by lending, investing, and buying bonds. Right now, US commercial banks hold about $4.6 trillion in treasury bonds and other government securities, which is more than the GDP of Japan or India. Bonds are particularly popular because they're one of the safest ways to earn interest. And unlike stocks that swing wildly every day, a 10-year US government bond today pays a steady annual interest rate, offering reliable returns with little risk. But banks aren't alone in this. Pension funds, insurance companies, and investment firms all do the same. So essentially, private savings have become an indirect form of government borrowing. And although it sounds odd that the US borrows from itself, think of it as money moving from parts of the country where it's sitting idle to parts where it's needed. When the government pays interest on its debt, the money flows back to lenders, giving them more cash to buy more bonds and earn more interest. It's a closed loop where money cycles endlessly from lender to borrower and back again. The same loop exists between countries. About 30% of US debt is held overseas. Foreign governments and banks buy US bonds the same way American institutions do. Money flows into the US when it borrows, flows back out when it pays interest, and the cycle repeats. And it's not just America that does this. Every country borrows and every country lends. Japanese savings are turned into loans for the Saudis. Saudi savings become loans for Brazilians. Brazilian capital flows back into US bonds. This interconnected web creates an uneasy reality. To repay debts, governments must keep borrowing more and more. That may sound reckless, and in many ways it is, but it's also the foundation of how the global economy now works. Everything from economic growth to political stability depends on this endless cycle continuing. Since debt fuels growth, governments have no choice but to borrow and spend and get money circulating in the economy. By doing so, businesses earn more, workers get paid, and as a result, they spend more. It becomes a feedback loop that keeps the economy expanding. In China, about a fifth of government spending is financed by borrowing. In the US, it's one in every $4. If governments stopped borrowing overnight, public spending would fall immediately. Money would stop flowing into the economy, businesses would earn less, layoffs would increase, and consumer spending would grind to a stop. That's precisely what happened when COVID hit in 2020. As people stopped spending and the economy shut down, governments stepped in and covered expenses people were unwilling to pay. In America, the government borrowed $3.1 trillion in a single year, which was about 12% of the economy at the time. China, Europe, and every other major economy did the same. It wasn't a choice, really, it was necessity. However, borrowed money must eventually be returned. If a government already spends everything it collects to keep the economy going, then it must take out new loans to repay the old ones. So, the debt never truly leaves the system, it just adds up. Wealthier countries, such as Germany and Switzerland, can afford to cycle through this system. Their bonds are considered safe, so they keep borrowing at low interest rates. But for developing nations, it's different. Higher borrowing costs make each rollover more expensive. Over time, debt starts to feed on itself. Countries like Kenya and Pakistan, for instance, are stuck in debt traps and forced to keep borrowing just to meet interest payments on past loans. So the same debt that strengthens some economies can end up holding others back. Debt-driven economies carry inherent dangers. No matter how smooth the cycle seems, risks are building beneath the surface. As governments continue borrowing, debt grows, and so do interest payments. Over time, a bigger slice of the budget goes toward paying off old loans, rather than funding schools, hospitals, or infrastructure. A debt-to-GDP ratio of about 100% is now considered normal. And frankly, debt is not a problem so long as borrowing is cheap and lenders are confident. But when political risks change and investors stop wanting to lend, borrowing costs shoot up. So perception is the real driver of the economy. One way governments keep a lid on things is by printing more money. Banks call it quantitative easing. The problem, however, is that when more money enters circulation, the value of each unit declines. The result is inflation and higher everyday costs. In extreme cases, it spirals out of control. In Zimbabwe in 2008, the government printed so much money to cover debts that prices doubled every single day. A loaf of bread that cost 10 million Zimbabwe dollars in March suddenly cost hundreds of millions by mid-year and billions by November. The government eventually printed $100 trillion notes to cope with the situation, but that only made it worse. The currency became worthless, and ordinary people saw their life savings vanish overnight. While most countries don't face such extremes, even moderate inflation can hurt. The risks are even bigger for developing countries, which often borrow in foreign currencies such as US dollars. Meaning, when their own currency weakens, debt repayments suddenly become more expensive in local terms, and as that burden grows, lenders start doubting the country's ability to repay. That's pretty much what happened in Turkey. Once the mood shifts and doubt sets in, investors tend to demand higher interest rates to compensate for the risks. And when borrowing hits a wall, governments are forced into ugly trade-offs. They can either cut spending, raise taxes, or expand the money supply. Each of these options comes with severe consequences. All in all, the global economy is wired for constant momentum. Debt isn't a flaw. It's what keeps nations running, borrowing, lending, spending, and starting over. This perpetual motion, however, can't keep going forever. Eventually, there will be a reckoning, an economic depression. Centuries ago, physics proved that perpetual motion is impossible. Economics is yet to come around. Before we wrap up, a quick shout out to Search Party. They produce sharp, well-researched videos on global affairs, and if you enjoy this channel, you'll get value there too. The link is below. I've been your host Shirvan from Caspian Report. If you approve of what we do, please leave a comment, hit the like button, and mayhaps share the video. In any case, thank you for your time, and sağ olun.